it's been the privilege, the presumption of intellectuals to say, as a new social innovation rides into town, suffer this, and the thing comes undone. We've watched that happen now for 300 years as the innovations come, you know, and accumulate, the sky never falls.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Grant McCracken, who is a research affiliate at MIT's Culture Convergence Consortium. Okay, thanks, Grant. You're also the author of a number of books we're going to discuss. Let's start with your latest, Chief Culture Officer. What's its premise, and why is it important for people to know about it?
The premise is that the corporate world is getting better at responding to the sheer dynamism of a competitive marketplace, but it systematically ignores the cultural content, the cultural developments that shape consumer taste and preference.
So in the book, one of the examples you used was Motorola's Razr phone.
Sure. Jeffrey Frost was a guy who'd worked for Nike and a couple of other companies, and he came to Motorola and discovered that it was a corporation that practiced death by committee, stalling good ideas in the innovation process. And he knew especially that they had a tin ear when it came to culture. So when he saw this handset come out of the lab, he thought, oh, two things. First of all, this can work in our contemporary culture. But he also knew that he had to keep it away from the inclination of the corporation to kill things in committee. So he sort of snuck it through under the cover of darkness, brought it to marketplace. So he's a kind of naturally occurring CCO.
You call for the creation of the chief culture officer in corporations or in businesses that are selling stuff. What would a chief culture officer do?
I think they would have the daunting task of keeping track of everything that's happening. And the one example I use in the book is Alice Waters creating Chez Panisse in 1973. At some point, you want to have a CCO in place who can say, you know, this tiny little innovation that took place in Cooksville, California, is actually rushing towards the mainstream, and you want to pick that up as soon as possible.
Talk about the book that you're finishing up soon, tentatively titled or fully titled Culturematic. What is it about, and how does it fit into your unfolding work?
The book runs on two rails. One is how the corporation creates innovation, which, as you know, is a hot topic. The other is how do individuals with their own lives engage in experiments that help shape and define who they are.
So what's an example of a Culturematic?
Reality TV.
This is the true story. True story.
Of seven strangers.
At a time when MTV was no longer able to rely on rock or music videos, it needed another cheap source of programming. And someone said, well, what if we, all these Culturematics begin with this little what if. And in this case it was, well, what if we just stuck some people in a house and we had, you know, high-end cameras and the sound won't be very good, but this could be interesting. You know, it really fought, I think, the instincts of everybody who had made television up to that date, in which model you spend $2 million to make a pilot, which goes more often doesn't go. And this is a cheap and cheerful model.
How do you respond to critics who are just like, well, look at reality TV. This is a debasement of everything that is good and normal of mom, Chevrolet, and apple pie.
I think what they're missing is the sky is not falling, and it hasn't ever fallen. And it's been the privilege, the presumption of intellectuals to say, as a new social innovation rides into town, giving the vote to women or giving property rights to, you know, in the 16th right. century or something, right? Whatever it is, some social innovation, you can depend upon intellectuals to get on their high horse and say, suffer this, and the thing comes undone. You give the vote to women, and you can just say goodbye to a stable society. We've watched that happen now for 300 years as the innovations come, you know, and accumulate, the sky never falls. So at some point,
we did give the women the vote, and now we have reality TV.
You think there's a line?
Your work, which I've been following at least since Plenitude, which was an online book published in the 90s and talked about the quickening speciation of social types in North America and Western Europe. What's the consistency or the through line in the work that you've been doing?
Right. I guess the big, I'm a transient anthropologist, as a classical anthropologist, and at some point in my career I thought I would begin to study contemporary culture, contemporary American culture. The big challenge there is that it doesn't look like almost anything we've ever seen in the traditional ethnographic handbook. So the question is, well, what's here that shouldn't be here, strictly speaking, and how do you account for it? And what was happening in the 90s was this fantastic speciation.
And this is that suddenly, I mean, yeah, I remember in Plenitude you talked about the tour that you took of a Toronto mall. with a teenager, and where when you were growing up, there were essentially three role models for boys. I mean, you could be what, a hood, a nerd, or a geek or something, or a jock.
Right.
And what did you find in the Toronto Mall?
There were something like 12 species of, and that's changed in a very interesting way. So kids used to have to make almost kind of vows of lifelong commitment to one group or another, and then they began to mix and match them. And now they're kind of modular. Now they're stylistic signatures more than they are anything.
Why are people reluctant to embrace that?
There's a notion that says, if I admit to the choices other people have made as they construct their lives, I somehow, as and when those depart from my own, I'm somehow repudiating my own choices. And in a world of plenitude, there's no repudiation.
Is there a politics, either explicit or embedded in your work?
Well, to the extent that it stems from cultural motives, and to the extent that it manifests itself, for me at least, as an anthropologist, in a cultural frame, I can talk about it without talking about politics. But if I extrapolate, if I make political assumptions, I think the chief one is, geez, good, you know, structurally stable things happen when existing institutions forego their claim to decide who should say what about whom in what contexts.
When you accept that change is the only constant, ironically, you get a more stable social structure.
Kind of. I mean, that's the big anthropological question is there, remember when people were writing software, they would talk about kernels, the smallest instruction set you could actually establish in order to get the maximum amount of code. That's the open question. What is the kernel? What is the minimum instruction set? And maybe there's a point at which we embrace certain kinds of innovation that explode that, and then we're in for it. But we keep thinking that's our reflex. I'm speaking down perhaps as Canadian, but I mean that's our reflex that the thing's going to come undone, and it just doesn't.
Well, I want to thank Grant McCracken, author of Plenitude, Chief Culture Officer, and forthcoming Culturematic, for talking with Reason TV. I'm Nick Gillespie.